Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:13 p.m. on March 21st, 2012. President, we have, Representative Pruitt, Representative Keller, Representative Holmes, and myself, Chair Representative Thompson. Representative Gatto is excused again today. Start with housekeeping. Please turn off your cell phones. Just putting them to vibrate still interferes with the recording equipment in this room. Okay, today we have one new bill, House Bill 292, relating to property, retirement insurance, interest, et cetera, and this is sponsored by myself. And then we have Senate Bill 89, Legislative Ethics Act, sponsored by Senator Coghill. First up, we will continue with Senate Bill 89, which is the Legislative Ethics Act, which at this time return to amendments. Which brings the committee back to Amendment 0.2, which was labeled as Amendment Number 2. There it is, Number 2. As the committee remembers, Amendment 2 inserts the words "and volunteers" after the word "interns" on page 11, line 8, and page 11, line 11. This amendment makes volunteers subject to the Legislative Ethics Act. We do have further amendments to this to address volunteers. And Representative Grunberg has joined us. Ms. Moss, do you have anything to add?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. For the record, Reneva Moss, staff to Senator Coghill, and I've asked Joyce Anderson with the Ethics Committee to join me for questions and comments. Amendment 2, as you said, does add volunteers back into the statute so they would be required to conform with the ethics laws, and under a subsequent amendment that we have attached here, after serving a certain length of time as a volunteer, they would be required to take the ethics course.
Okay. Questions from committee on this? Ms. Anderson, do you want to add anything to this time?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, move amendment number 2. Is that what you want?
Amendment number 2, is there any objection to...
Is that this one?
No.
No, it's the one that we have...
discussion.
Representative Holmes?
Yeah, this is simply the amendment that we had tabled the other day that adds volunteers to interns. And because there's a subsequent amendment that we had tabled it because we wanted to figure out whether or not somebody had to take the ethics course if they just showed up for one day or what the timing is, we have a subsequent amendment, as Ms. Moss said, that will deal with that. So I think that we've satisfied the reason for tabling the motion. So.
Could I just have a minute? This is some slight disagreement. I apologize.
Well, he's Representative Pruitt.
Question for Ms. Anderson.
Miles?
Can you help me understand? A volunteer, of course, as I came in to this body, I had to take certain courses with yourself. And of course, as legislative aides come in, they need to do the same thing. Currently, how do we handle volunteers? And should they have certain, should there be certain ethical similarity? I guess, should we do some of the similar things that we're requiring both aides and legislators to do, because they're going to affect the public process here if they're volunteering. They're going to be a part of making law or changing law or whatnot.
Joyce Anderson, for the record, Administrator for the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics, Representative Pruitt through the chair. Currently, the statute did not require volunteers or interns to take training, but we did recommend that they do, and so that's why there was a change in the statute. The training statute requires that you complete training within 30 days. And I hate to move ahead with a subsequent amendment, but I think it's important at this point that we were going to put in that a volunteer who is on board for 30 days would take the training. So it would be within the 30-day, after the 30 days time frame, but just because it's required to be done within 30 days.
Can I follow up?
Follow-up question, Representative Pruitt.
So, and here's another concern. 30 days is still a nice chunk of time. A lot of things can be done. Let's say that someone understands the process, but they have not had to, I mean, they don't have to file a financial disclosure or a close economic association. They don't have to do these various things. 30 days is quite a bit of time. They can do a lot of things without being under the same public scrutiny that we require both ourselves as legislators and the aides to be under. Should we do something to the effect of maybe for one individual cumulative 30 days, so someone can't come for 30 to for 29 days, leave, come back and volunteer at a later point in time, and get around this potential issue, or get around having to take the ethical training, ethics training that we require of everyone else?
Penny Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two responses to that. The first is that this is actually the next amendment that we're already debating, so we might want to wait and take this up with the next amendment.
Okay.
But also, when we get to the next amendment, you'll see that it's actually 30 days within a legislature, which is the entire two-year period of the 27th legislature. So I think that would address your concern of they work. It's not 30 consecutive days. It's 30 days within an entire two-year legislative cycle.
I think it's entirely appropriate so that we can debate it, I guess, appropriately. Yeah. But
Mr. Chairman, I look for. I think it's entirely, and I think the sponsor would agree, and that it's probably entirely within the purview of the committee to debate whether 30 days is too long. And I think we should have that conversation in about 90 seconds.
The volunteer itself has, there's a lot of issues related to that, and I want to make sure that we flesh all this out, so please.
Okay, we do have a motion by Representative Keller to move amendment number two. Is there any objection?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
I'm trying to make some sales out of my file. Do we have amendment 0.3 somewhere?
I think we do. It's coming up next.
Is this the one we're talking about?
Yeah,
is this
that's the one.
Got it. Not numbered.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. This directly relates to this. Could anybody later go to 3?
Here's
0.3. I see. And 0.3 will be offered subsequently?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, seeing no objection to amendment number 2, it's adopted.
Mr. Chairman, I think I might have objected for discussion, so I'll officially remove my objection.
Then no further objection, then we have adopted amendment number 2. Can I have a motion to bring amendment number 3 before the committee?
Mr. Chair, I move amendment number 0.3, which we'll call number 3.
Amendment number 3 is 0.3.
And I'll object for discussion.
Objection for discussion. Okay, Ms. Moss, can you tell us, the committee, what number 3 does?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Number 3 addresses Representative Holmes' concerns yesterday. That was really an oversight on our part, because this definitely needs to go back into the statute.
We're trying to listen to Representative Holmes.
Basically, it puts the ethics course requirements for interns and volunteers the same as employees and legislators, so that within the first 10 days of a legislature, they would have to have training, and if it wasn't within that time period, if they had served an aggregate amount of 30 days within a legislature, which is a two-year term, they would have to take an ethics course.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Keller.
Would it be appropriate, and I'm asking the sponsored representative or Joyce, would it be appropriate to make some kind of a statement in there that the whoever the responsible for the volunteer is responsible for their ethical training in that 30-day period?
Representative Keller, through the chair. So, in other words, what you're saying is that, let's say, a legislator has a volunteer in their office, that the legislator would be responsible. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm asking. I'm wondering if we shouldn't include that in this amendment, because, you know, so we avoid the potential argument of somebody saying, "Well, there's no requirement." You know, somebody acts unethically and there's no responsibility given, and, you know, it just seems like by being so specific as we are with this amendment, we may be implying that nobody's responsible here, and it just seems like it might not hurt to point out that, in the typical case, that the legislator that takes on the volunteer has some responsibility for how a volunteer acts, who, you know, in the name of, in his name, in his office.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think to be clear, my understanding, and Joyce and Raineva can correct me if I'm wrong, is that the volunteer, the minute they, under the amendment we just passed, the volunteer, the moment they step into the building as a volunteer in an office, are covered by the Legislative Ethics Act, including all the confidentiality provisions and all of that. It's not 30 days later that kicks in. So they are still entirely responsible for all of the ethical. It's just this is the timeline for at what point they must actually go through the training. So I'm not sure that I agree with, I think, to some extent, the thought that a responsible legislator would make sure that somebody who comes into their office and is covered by the Ethics Act would know that they're covered by the Ethics Act, but I don't know that we want to actually make legislators, we want to be careful fully making them responsible for somebody else's actions while they're in their office.
Through the chair, Representative
Keller.
Thank you. I do not mean to be advocating for this. I was asking, you know, the opinion of Joyce or and/or Raineva.
Mr. Chairman, on page 11, section 11, that is where it says that and you just adopted an amendment that says applicability to legislative interns and volunteers. They are bound by all the ethics laws except the ethics course on the day that they step into that office. And then once they have met the aggregate of 30 days during a two-year legislative session, then they are required to take the course.
Thank you. That helps.
And Mr. Chair, if I could comment, I do believe that it would be in the legislator's best interest to inform that volunteer when they come on board that they are covered by the ethics code. And if the legislator certainly wants that individual to go through the ethics training course, which we have online prior to the 30 days, that would be your prerogative as well. And it's possible that by explaining to the intern and the volunteer that they are covered by the ethics codes, they may want to do that just to see what their requirements are so that they don't get in trouble themselves. So there's that part of it as well.
Yeah, about 10 minutes ago we were joined by Representative Lynn. I forgot to mention that. Representative Keller, go ahead.
Yeah, I think just putting this on the record is sufficient. So,
We also have Terry Thurbin from the Office of Administrative Hearings in the room for questions, and we have online Dan Wayne from the Ledge Legal for questions also. Representative Pruitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. in your opinion, Joyce, can an individual who comes in who has not taken the course yet, even though they're technically under the ethics rules that the rest of us are, the fact that they haven't been trained, could they, if they violated some sort of ethics rule, use that in their own defense of, but I was not trained, I was not able to go, I didn't have enough time, whatever it is, to go through the training, could they use that in their defense, and would that be something that could cause some problems later?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, if there was a complaint filed against an individual, it actually would be the Ethics Committee's call as to whether they would take that into consideration. During my training classes, when I conduct ethics training, I always say ignorance of the law is not an excuse. But I understand what you're saying. So again, that's what I was saying with Representative Keller. I think it's important for you as a legislator to let your staff know that they are covered by the ethics code. Because even your staff that comes on board, let's say you have someone that comes on board today, we're notified by personnel that they have come on board, and we notify them that they have to take that training class within 30 days. Because that's the time frame it is. But you as a legislator might want to push that and say, well, I want you to do that within the next 5 days. So again, I think some of the responsibility falls on the legislator. I'm not sure that really needs to be in statute. I don't know if I'm answering your question completely. But
and actually, if you don't mind, if I can dialogue just a little bit. I think you answered the question on the individual itself. What about the legislator? Could something fall on them for having said, Joe Schmo, you need to make sure that you do this and watch out for this, etc., but they didn't cover everything, and they come back and say, well, I was working for ex-legislator. I hadn't had the time to take the course. They didn't tell me everything that I noted, or they didn't tell me I needed to take the course within 5 years or whatnot. Could have fallen the legislator.
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, I would say it would have to be a very fact-specific situation, so I couldn't generalize what your answer would be, but if you had directed the legislative staff person to perform a particular function that was not ethical under the ethics code, I would assume the ethics committee would look at that to see exactly what it was you directed that person to do, and they didn't know they shouldn't be doing it. I don't know. Again, it would be the ethics committee's call.
Appreciate it. Thank you for that. Just in a question in a different vein.
All right, Andrew, I'm going through it.
And just shifting a little bit of gears, is someone that comes in potentially could have a considerable amount of knowledge of how the process goes, because maybe they did. I think Representative Gruberg mentioned something about people who had maybe been here in the past, who'd been around, maybe they'd worked here and whatnot, and they could, coming back into the building. Should we? I don't think we currently do, but should we require even volunteers to note if they've got any sort of economic association with any outside groups? I mean, they are potentially going to have an impact, even if they're only here for less than 30 days. They could potentially have impact on certain pieces of legislation that could have some sort of connection to maybe someone that they're working for, maybe an industry that they're involved with, and the public should be aware of that.
Representative Pruitt, through the chair. Legislative employees right now are not required to file anything, any type of a financial disclosure or anything like that.
Close
economic association, unless it's with a legislator, a lobbyist, another public official. However, when a legislative staffer calls me and asks if there's a prohibition on outside employment, the first thing I tell them is to let your legislator know, because there might be a conflict regarding work duties as well as a time commitment. So no, there's nothing in the statute that states that, but I think that that's an important point that you bring up, and usually when staffers call me, that's the first thing I say. Because if they're working for a conservation organization and you're working on a bill that's either in that area or opposed to that particular area, then they might have some sort of a conflict of interest. And so there's nothing in the statute, but I do provide advice to people when they call with that type of information. And that's one of the reasons also why board memberships are filed. So if they are on the board of that particular organization, then that becomes public information. If they're just a member and not a board member, no, we wouldn't know that, but for a board member, we would. So that's another way that information is transparent in public.
Yeah, thank you. And if you guys don't mind, I'll pick on the two staffers that are here. There's no. But right now, of course, we have two staffers, and of course, they work here. We know if they have to declare. If let's say Jane's on the board of some nonprofit, we have to be aware that she's on that board. I think someone that is a volunteer, though, is in a completely different situation, because unlike where Jane and James both are full-time with the staff, we know what they're doing most of their time. We don't know about these volunteers, and I think that's something that I'm a little bit concerned about, because I could go out and find, let's say that I have a particular issue, I could go out and ask someone in the issue that I have a concern with and say, hey, can you volunteer some time for the next 20 days? They don't have to take the ethics course. They don't have to, at this point, they don't have to declare any conflict, and they could potentially have an impact on legislation that could affect all Alaskans. And I think that's something we may need to, we might want to think about addressing.
So, Mr. Chair, if I could address that. Yeah. I represent Pruitt through the chair. One of the statutes that legislative interns and volunteers is covered under is AS 2460.030, and under that particular section, you are required to file a board membership. So they would be required to file that as well. So that part is covered.
That part is covered.
Okay. Okay.
That part I do know.
Okay.
And I apologize for if that was confused. That board memberships they do, but it could be someone's working for X industry. And through oil and gas, we deal with it a lot right now. I could actually ask a volunteer from
from one of the oil and gas companies to come and spend 20 days in my office, and they could have a dramatic impact on that legislation when they shouldn't be, because they work for, or at least it should be declared so that people in the public understand that they work for that company. And they, and I think that's something, again, I think that's something we might want to think about addressing.
Mr. Chair, if I could comment, I know on the state level, a lot of employees that come from the state to work for the legislature, the first thing they will do when they call me and when they come on board is, do I need to disclose my outside employment? We don't require that, but the state does in some manner, and I'm not quite sure which, but they do require disclosure of outside employment.
Okay.
Thank you. Further discussion on amendment number 3. Seeing none, is the objection still?
I withdraw my objection.
Okay, with objection is withdrawn.
Just a question, Mr. Chair.
Question, Representative Grunberg.
For the record, I forget who offered number 3.
Me.
Representative Keller.
I just keep track of these things.
I see.
I'm a Santa Claus.
Is it coming back and bite us then? Maybe you look me up.
Yeah. Coming after you, Wes.
Okay, seeing no further objection, amendment number 3 is accepted. Next we have amendment number 4. We have a motion to adopt amendment number 4.
What is that?
That's your amendment.
Oh, okay. Chair, we're getting to my stuff.
And that's 0.4 is amendment number 4.
Mr. Chair, before we get to that, may I ask a question? Is that okay?
I'll go right ahead.
On page 5, line 30, I don't think we are deleting or arranging, that we'll have to hear from Terry Thurbin on this one. Okay, so the one we're looking at, Mr. Chair,
is 0.4, which is amendment 4. I need a motion to...
I move amendment number 4, labeled 0.4.
I'll object for discussion purposes. Representative Grunberg, would you like to address that?
Sure. This actually was, these are ones that I prepared. There's an opinion that Ms. Anderson has provided to me, which is here in the pile somewhere. It's a committee, joint committee opinion that, among other things, asked the question, here it is. It's advisory opinion 2004-02. And one of the questions that was asked, whether there are any restrictions under the Legislative Ethics Code on a legislator with a financial interest in legislation, and that's really a substantial interest, according to...
Mr. Chairman, I don't think this is germane to this amendment.
Yes.
Amendment number 4.
We're on
0.4.
Oh, I'm on 7.
Most of us are 0.4, which is amendment number 4. I wondered where we were at. I
thought, page 5.
Where are you at?
Page 5, line 25. After the word hearing, insert the words whose names are public.
Mr. Chairman, this is the one that has to do with, the question is, how can the legislator notify somebody that they've had an inadvertent ex parte communication if the names of the parties aren't actually public?
So Ms. Moss, would you tell the committee about amendment number 4?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. This was brought up on Monday when Representative Holmes brought up the issue that there could be names of parties that are not public information. One I could think of is possibly in a China case. You have minor children whose names are not disclosed, so this takes care of that situation.
All right. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize to you. This is a day of confusion in the Epstein-Grunberg house.
Anytime we can confuse you, we enjoy it.
I just want you to know that Tuffy went to the groomer and is in such a state he's sedated.
So don't blame the wife and the puppy.
Yeah. Okay. Mr. Chairman, that's the dog ate my homework.
Okay. Okay. Great. May I just, if I may, could we have this?
On amendment number 4?
Yeah. Yeah. No, this is not right.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, could I ask indulgence from the committee? Could we table this for a minute? I can get mine done, and I'll show you it's different, but this is not done. Can we come back to this in a few minutes?
And then this would be...
That's probably the one he wants right here.
But yeah, it's not done correctly here.
Okay, no, so...
Wait a minute, maybe...
This is the one.
Oh, I'm sorry. It is.
Okay.
I'm sorry. This is. Let me tell you you're going to have to do something here.
Can we
have a brief at ease?
Max, we're on ODOT.
And we have amendment number 4 before us. We've had a request to rewrite that.
Mr. Chair, I would offer mine.
We need a microphone.
We still have.
I would offer the handwritten as an amendment to 04 in the nature of a substitute.
Mr. Chair, I withdraw amendment 0.4. We've been calling number 4, and now you're on to amendment number 5.
Okay, number 4 is
okay with you,
withdrawn. We will call this handwritten one number 5. There's your motion to adopt number 5.
I will offer that.
Okay.
Objection.
And I would like to ask Terry Thurbin to please come forward on this particular one.
Would you like me to explain it first?
Yeah, while she's coming forward, go ahead and explain.
Can you read it?
Yes.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay.
You have a copy of the handwritten? Okay.
Okay. We are on page 5, lines 25 to 26. And in place of both of those lines, my language would read, employee, so promptly disclosed by the legislator or legislative employee, to all parties to the hearing, and then insert new language, whose names are public, and to the hearing officer for transmittal to all parties whose names are not public. And then we would have to leave the contact is made a part of the record. So in other words, it's very simple. If your parties are public, you transmit the disclosure to them. If the parties' names are not public, you transmit it to the hearing officer, and their office will transmit it to the unnamed parties. And make sure everybody's notified and confidentiality's not broken. And I would hope it would be acceptable and in the spirit of the original amendment number 4.
Okay, Representative Grunberg, on the bill itself, the contact is deleted. Do you want it to be put back in with this?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir. Because it's a dual requirement that if it's inadvertent, you must transmit it, and you must say on the record that you've had this inadvertent contact. So without revealing any confidential names of the transmittees, it's on the record that you've had an inadvertent and ex parte communication. So the record is complete. That's what we have to leave language in.
Okay, if I could get Ms. Thurbin to please put yourself and an affiliation on the record, and we'd like your comments on this amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Terry Thurbin. I'm the state's chief administrative law judge, which means I'm agency head for the Office of Administrative Hearings, which hears a bunch of the executive branch adjudicatory matters, but not everything. And I take it you want my reaction to the proposed amendment, if
yes.
I understood you correctly. The proposed amendment would do what, as a practical matter, would have to be done if there were any private secret name parties. And there are examples. China cases really generally are not administrative proceedings, but there are substantiated abuse or neglect cases. In child support, we have cases where one parent is trying to get the contact information from another parent, and the other parent's resisting because there's an alleged history of domestic violence or a threat of harm. So there are some cases in which if an inadvertent contact occurred and the legislator or legislative employee wanted to try to make the disclosure that's contemplated here, they wouldn't be able to get the names, at least not from us. They would have the name of whoever it was, their constituent who had contacted them perhaps, but they might not have all the names. And in a situation like that, what would happen as a practical matter is the disclosure would get made to the administrative law judge in my shop, or if it were not a central hearing panel office of administrative hearings case, to the appropriate person who's hearing the case. And then if the disclosure included an indication that, hey, I don't know who the other parties are, and so I can't I can't disclose directly to them, would you forward this, then that would happen. So as a practical matter, I think that's how it would play out with no amendment at all under the language as proposed in the bill.
So you're saying basically that this amendment is not necessary because it's already done?
Well, what I'm saying, Mr. Chairman, is that as a practical matter where you have an organized tribunal like my office that's hearing these cases, that's what would happen as the workaround for the legislator or legislative employee's inability to contact people for whom they don't have identities or contact information. We would do the distribution. Now, in the interest of full disclosure, there are some case types in the executive branch that are not necessarily handled by a professional hearing staff. They might be handled by an executive branch employee at the commissioner level or lower who might have some assistance and some system in place where they could receive the disclosure and do the same thing, the same sort of distribution. I can't guarantee you that they would be organized to do that, but I suspect if the disclosure itself, if it were done in a written form and the same sort of I don't have the mailing list, could you forward this request was made, that would probably happen.
Representative Keller.
Just for discussion on this, maybe you could throw some light on it, but it seems to me like this puts a burden on the legislator to the point that you'd be very careful before you inquire about anything. Because, if you may happen to call the wrong person, then you got this check mark, things you got to do. And, we get pretty busy, and that makes me squirm.
Mr. Sheriff.
Representative Pruitt.
No comments.
Representative Grunberg.
It does put a burden, but you certainly know if you contacted somebody inadvertently. You know, this only applies if you subsequently learn you contacted a party and it was not intentional, and then certainly the canons of ethics if you're a lawyer, and a lot of these people, most legislators are not lawyers, but you must reveal that. It's just super important that the parties know if a legislator has contacted somebody, even if it's a small burden on the legislature. This is such an important thing. It deals with the very integrity of the process. And even if this would be the general practice of the Office of Administrative Hearings, I think it's important we have it in, because many of the people involved will not be lawyers and will not know, and this will make certain that if a legislator who doesn't have to be intimately familiar with this learns that they've had this contact, they'll learn what they have to do and they'll transmit it, and the integrity of the process will be upheld. That's why I'm offering it.
Ms. Moss, do you have any comments on the amendment?
Mr. Chairman, with what Terry said, I think it would be appropriate to adopt this amendment, because to answer Representative Keller's comment, this notification was a remedy to the alternative, which would be an ethics violation and a possible fine. And because this already seems to be what's in practice, I don't think it hurts to clarify it in the statute.
Thank you. All right. Any further discussion or questions on amendment number 5? Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. I just want to, for the record, it's a conceptual amendment, and we'll ask Legal and everybody to make sure it's done properly. I hope it's right.
Okay, I withdraw my objection on amendment number 5. Is there any further objection? If not, then we have adopted conceptual amendment number 5. Okay. And this brings us back.
We have one.
A couple more amendments, do we?
Mr. Chair.
One more. Representative Grunberg.
I was wondering if Representative Holmes had more amendments.
We have one more that's been distributed. I'm not sure who it's from.
Or a rate-making proceeding?
Page 5, line 30, delete.
Excuse me.
It could be amendment number 6.
But what does this say?
Mr. Chairman?
Ms. Moss.
This amendment is to address something that was a concern to Representative Grunberg yesterday, and we wanted Terry Thurman here to
discuss this because...
I'll move amendment number 6 for discussion purposes.
I don't know what we're talking about.
I'll object for discussion.
Been objected. Okay, Ms. Moss, go right ahead.
Is this the rate making? Oh, I see. Oh, I see.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenberg brought up an issue yesterday. I think it's possible that some people misread this section yesterday. Actually, the way it is written under existing law, rate-making proceedings would be excluded from the definition of administrative hearings. This amendment deletes the words or a rate-making proceeding so that rate-making proceedings would be considered administrative hearings.
Everybody understand that?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenberg.
Ms. Moss is correct. She and Mr. Brooks and I discussed this. I was thinking after that discussion, this is kind of a double negative. If the amendment is adopted, then a legislature will be able to participate before rate making. Am I correct? Or am I
Mr. Chairman, if the amendment is adopted, a legislator would not be able to participate or influence. Yes, other than open comment, but they would not be allowed to try to influence a rate-making proceeding decision.
Mr. Representative Greenberg.
So they would be able to testify, but they couldn't have other communications. I see Ms. Anderson nodding correctly. Okay, I just wanted to be sure because I'm getting turned around on some of these things.
Okay. Further discussion?
I think the intent was to have Ms. Thurman.
Pardon?
We have Ms. Thurman come up.
Ms. Thurman, could I have you come up on this amendment also?
Help us wade through the weeds.
we're tripping through the weeds here.
Yes.
Here. Sure. Terry Thurman again. Was there a particular question, or you want me to comment on the amendment? Or
please comment.
Please comment.
Well, I'm going to confess to a little bit of ignorance about rate-making proceedings, because my office doesn't hear rate-making proceedings. We hear appeals sometimes that result from rates that are made through rate-making proceedings. The Regulatory Commission of Alaska is one of the key players that engages in rate-making. I think Linda Hall is here in the room and may have something to say about insurance rate-making. My sort of naive understanding is that there is a phase of a rate process that is more quasi-legislative. Public hearings, the commission or individual or board establishing a rate that is much more of a quasi-legislative process than a quasi-judicial process. As I said, later on there can be adjudication matters that come out of those. We hear Medicaid, or soon we'll be hearing Medicaid rate appeals, but that's not the rate-making process so much as it is as challenges to how the rates are being applied. And because of that, our statutory definition of administrative hearings does exclude rate-making proceedings for some of the same reasons that it excludes other things like informal conference. Those are not classic adjudications. I have no opinion on whether, as a matter of legislative ethics, you want rate-making proceedings in or out of this this provision, but certainly the statutory definition that's in our law that was the model for the language as it's in the original bill, it would not be appropriate to include rate-making or to exclude them from the exclusion, essentially, is what it would be, is to say that they, we're going to treat them like they're administrative adjudications because they're not, at least up to a certain point. Does that answer the question?
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it does, and I think it argues for us not passing the amendment because it would, and I appreciate the Ms. Moss bringing it forward to have this discussion, but I think it sounds like being consistent with how the administrative hearings are done, I think we should be consistent there and probably not pass this amendment.
Representative
Greenberg. That was actually very helpful.
Thank you. I was confused yesterday. I've got to say I'm a little more confused today. Okay. I would recommend we withdraw the amendment, and we can consider it further at some point, or the legislature can, but if in doubt, don't.
In doubt, don't.
I would hope
to Okay. If you'll withdraw your objection, I'll withdraw my motion to amend at number 6.
Withdraw, yes.
And I'll withdraw amendment number 6. Okay.
Okay.
Now we have more handed to us.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Representative Grunberg.
Okay. What I'm going to do, and these are kind of backwards, the first one is going to be 0.5, and that will be amendment number 7, and I'll offer amendment number 7.
I'll object for discussion purposes.
0.5.
The third one.
Okay. It's the very bottom.
Simple backwards.
Okay.
It deletes, quote, our hourly employees who, unquote.
I'll object. Have we objected for discussion yet?
Yeah, I did. Okay.
So if the members would kindly look at page 13, lines 22 and 23. We discussed this last time. The main thing we're concerned about is that the disclosure requirements and everything do not include people who perform functions that are incidental to legislative functions, the folks who maintain security in the building, the messengers, maintenance people, print shop employees, and people like that who don't have anything to do with the substance of what we do. And it's kind of irrelevant whether they're paid on an hourly basis or not. So I talked with Ms. Moss about this. I think the sponsor will have no objection to this, and it just removes something that really isn't a relevant criteria.
We also have online Dan Wayne, who sent the memo along with the draft of these. Ms. Moss, do you have a comment on resolution or amendment number 7?
Mr. Chairman, Joyce Anderson and I have discussed this, and the key word is incidental, so we don't have a problem.
Okay. Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And my concern is just going to be, and I think that as long as we can figure out who falls into which category without too much trouble, I think that's probably right. I think the hourly probably was an attempt to not have, as Moss said, the Christmas tree. I just want to make sure that we will at some point get some kind of guidance from ethics that will sort of give us more information on who is in and who isn't not, so that everybody's clear. I'm hoping that ethics can help us kind of less.
Hi, Representative Holmes, through the chair. We certainly can look at that, and the one process could be an advisory opinion, defining this a little bit further, or the other thing could be a discussion at a committee meeting, and we'll bring it up to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just think clarity was always helpful when you figure out who's in and who's out, so I would appreciate that.
Further discussion on amendment number 7. I'll withdraw my objection. Any further objection? Seeing none, amendment number 7 is adopted. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. The next amendment, as amendment number 8, I am going to...
Is that 0.6?
Is that 0.6?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
And if the members would look at page 5...
You want to move amendment 8?
Oh, sorry. I move amendment 8.
I'll object for discussion purposes.
What page?
Page 5, line 28.
It's 0.6. And it goes to page 5, line 28. And it will, after the word agency on line 29, it will state what we mean by a quasi-judicial hearing. And if the members would look at the case excerpt I provided, it's from City of St. Paul v. State Department of Natural Resources, 137P3rd, Pacific 3rd, 261-265, Alaska, 2006, where the Supreme Court defined the term administrative adjudication, which is the same as a quasi-judicial hearing. And what we did, Mr. Wayne did at my request, was boil this lengthy definition down. So we put it in the statute, and I'm putting it on the record that the intention of this language is to codify that portion from City of St. Paul versus State Department of Natural Resources. It's a well-accepted definition, and it's so that there is no question as what we mean by this key term, quasi-judicial hearing, in the Legislative Ethics Act.
Ms. Moss?
Mr. Chairman, I guess my concern with this is that with the testimony we just had from Ms. Thurbin, that we're not confusing legislators even more. And that would be my comment.
Representative Greenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe we could ask Ms. Thurbin to come and give us her thoughts on this.
Please come forward, Ms. Thurbin.
It's my intention to make it clearer for legislators.
Terry Thurbin, Office of Administrative Hearings. Having not even read the amendment, I guess this is going to sound a little bit like a lawyer's dodge, but it's not really appropriate for me as a judge, maybe it's a judge's dodge, to comment on the policy decisions that this body makes regarding what you want in your Ethics Act. In my mind, the difference between quasi-judicial and quasi-legislative and executive action versus adjudicatory action. It's all very clear, but I do this for a living. And so I think it would be up to the committee if you think there's the need for clarity to put a definition in. As far as the definition, I can look at it real quickly here.
And do you have the case, Andy?
I have read the case. I just hadn't read the amendment yet.
The excerpt, if you want it.
Well, I would agree that the definition is consistent with how they talked about it in the case, and I have no opinion on whether it's going to make more confusing or less confusing the legislator and legislative employees' attempt to comply with the code.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and understanding that we all just saw this, and so I'm pretty uncomfortable making this on the fly with something that, but anyway, would it make the two sections consistent? Because it says what it, now it would flesh out a little more what it does include, and then there's the second half of that paragraph that says what it doesn't include. I want to make sure we're not creating internal inconsistencies.
Or more confusion.
Oh, I'm sorry, you're talking about the original language.
Right, it does not include, it includes that, but it's not.
I apologize, Representative Holmes. I didn't quite follow the thrust of your question. But
if we were to pass this amendment, I just want to make sure that subsection J wouldn't have any sort of internal inconsistencies between the part that says, you know, defines what an administrative hearing is, and then the part that says what an administrative hearing is not.
Well, I guess through the chair, Representative Holmes, I guess the slight disconnect that I see is, although quasi-judicial appears in the first part of the clause, the does not include clause then turns to talking about non-adjudicative public hearings. So there's not really the, you know, the commonality of that phrase, quasi-judicial, in the second part. So I'm not seeing that this amendment would have any effect on the does not include.
Well, that was what I wanted to be sure. I wanted to make sure there wasn't any attention.
That's my on-the-fly assessment.
On-the-fly assessment.
Okay. Further discussion on amendment number 8? I'll maintain my objection. Susan, can we have a vote on amendment number 8? Representative Greenberg had a further comment.
You know, when I looked at it, as a lawyer, as something that would make it clear both to the legislator and to the select committee, who would ultimately be sitting as judges on somebody who was alleged to have violated this. And this seems to be a very well-accepted definition of quasi-judicial or administrative adjudicative proceeding. And I just thought that would make it clear that that's what we're talking about here, since for the first time, we're really attempting to clarify in the Legislative Ethics Act what is going to be a violation of our canons of ethics. And I think it's important for the people who are affected, the legislators, and also for those who will be sitting in judgment on them, that there be a clearly defined, well-recognized definition. Because otherwise I could see there be some confusion, and at least potentially, and I'm just trying to eliminate that. But if I don't want to create more confusion, but I want to make it the system have some certainty, and by providing a definition, I think that helps provide the certainty.
I worry that it does create more confusion to us non-attorneys especially. So I'll maintain my objection. Susan, let's do a vote on amendment number 8.
I'll withdraw the amendment if you think that's better. I'm not going to.
Oh.
That's fine.
Okay.
I don't want to do it if people don't think it's a good idea, if there's objection.
I worry about it. Is the main thing.
Right. Well, let me ask you a question. Do you think that the term needs to be defined, or should we just leave it as it is?
I got the impression that leaving it as it is would be sufficient.
Okay,
you're withdrawing amendment number 8?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So we have 0.7, which will be number 9. Representative Greenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move amendment number 9.
Object.
Okay, we have amendment number 9, and we have the objection. You want to explain amendment number 9, Mr.
Greenberg? This was what I mistakenly thought we were getting at before, but in advisory opinion 2004-02, the question was whether there are any restrictions, whether you have to reveal if there's a conflict of interest if you're discussing and voting on a bill while in committee. And it's clear that you have to, under the statutes and the rules, disclose this if you're voting on the floor. But in a fairly lengthy part of the opinion, the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics held that the statutory prohibition requiring that you not vote in AS 2460-030G, which is this section here, only applies during a floor session, doesn't require disclosure and disqualification if you vote in committee. And they said that it's not within the purview of the committee, select committee, to engraft something that's not permitted under the statute, and that the uniform rules did not specify a committee, and the statute doesn't say that either. And I realize that this is not, we don't have an amendment to the uniform rule here, but I think at the very least it's important that we do what we can in the bill here that deals with the statute to clarify that the same standard should apply in committee, because we do most of our work in committee. And I think it should be on the record if you have a conflict or I have a conflict and the same standard applies, that would require unanimous consent to allow you to vote.
Ms. Moss.
Mr. Chairman, at first glance this seems reasonable, but in discussing it with Senator Coghill, he believes this is a way to manage the committee and floor process that is already managed through uniform rules and through Mason's rules, and that a change like this should be required to go through a uniform rule change, which requires a two-thirds vote.
If that's the feeling of the committee, I'm willing to withdraw the amendment. I just hope that we deal with it because it's an important issue for the public.
Representative Keller.
Yeah, Representative Greenberg, I entirely agree that it's very important that the public and each other knows our conflict of interest. Somebody's going to use that term. And I think we do that. We work together, sweat together, you know, so we know each other, know where we're coming from, and it needs to be brought up. But in addition to what Mr. Neely just mentioned, that, you know, we have disclosed that our disclosures, our connections, and I just think is unnecessary.
I'll withdraw.
We did that in my hearing the other day.
Okay, amendment number 9 has been withdrawn. That brings the amended SB 89 back to the committee. Further discussion?
I'm ready to make a motion if there's no discussion.
as amended and conceptually amended?
Well, that's a bunch of letters.
Yeah.
Okay, I move HCSCS SB9, 89, I'm sorry, version anyway, 0452 Oscar, as amended.
And conceptually amended.
And conceptually amended.
We went through the conceptual amendment, didn't we?
No, the 101 was conceptual.
That one is in, okay.
Okay. With committee recommendations and attached fiscal notes from the committee.
Okay, is there any objection? Seeing none, we have moved HB 89 out of committee, and we'll take a recess to sign.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for being here. Thank you for your presentation. Next is House Bill 292, the very long title, An Act Relating to Property Exemptions for Retirement Plans, and it goes on quite a bit. Here to present the bill is Jane Pearson, my Chief of Staff. Ms. Pearson, place yourself on the record and explain House Bill 292 to us.
For the record, my name is Jane Pearson, Staff to Representative Steve Thompson, and this is House Bill 292, An Act Relating to Property Exemptions for Retirement Plans, Individual Retirement Accounts, and Roth IRAs, relating to pleadings, orders, liability, and notices under the Uniform Property Code, relating to the appointment of trust property, relating to the Alaska Principal and Income Act, relating to the Alaska Uniform Transfers to Minors Act, relating to the disposition of human remains, relating to insurable interests for life insurance policies, relating to transfers of individual retirement plans, relating to the community property of married persons, and amending Rule 301A of the Alaska Rules of Evidence. House Bill 292 is this year's trust bill. As you can see from the title of the bill, it addresses many issues in Title 13. Specifically, this bill extends protection for retirement plan assets to the beneficiaries of retirement plans, often the surviving spouse, provides means of representation for minors and incapacitated persons in dealing with settlements of accounts or settlement agreements, amends the 2003 Alaska Principal and Income Act to conform with current IRS regulations, provides rules concerning who may control the disposition of decedents and remains, makes conforming amendments to Alaska's laws regarding insurable interests to align with changes in the Uniform Trust Code, provides that IRA interests can be voluntarily transferred to a family member or a trust, makes amendments to Alaska's community property provisions to update and clarify the ownership of community property, allows a beneficiary to extend the time funds will be held in uniform transfers to minors' accounts, and if it pleases the chair, I would like to ask that Dave Schaftel walk us through the sectional. This worked pretty well in the last committee, allowing members to ask questions as they arise. He is an expert in this field and can provide the committee with much better information than I can.
All right. Mr. Schaftel, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Get a little closer to the microphone, and please, for the record, tell us your name and your affiliation, and then go ahead with your sectional explanation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dave Schaftel. I'm an attorney in private practice in Anchorage. I practice in the area of estate planning and estate and trust administration. I'm a member of an informal group of trust and estate attorneys in Alaska and trust officers who have been working with the legislature since 1997 to recommend to the legislature changes to our estate and trust laws that would be beneficial to the residents of the state. This is really a very good kind of bread and butter bill that has a lot of very solid and important provisions in it. And Jane Pearson has given you a very good brief summary of these provisions. If you like, I'll go through the sectional analysis, would you like me, Mr. Chairman, to stop at each subject area and see if there are questions, or would you want me to go through the whole bill?
Go ahead and go through the bill, and if we see a question arise, I might stop you at that time, but go ahead and go through the bill with the sectional analysis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section 1 of the bill deals with asset protection for inherited retirement plans. Alaska statutes, like the statutes of most other states, protect from creditors the assets of a retirement plan with respect to the participant in the retirement plan. The majority rule now in the federal bankruptcy courts, after about 12 decisions in different courts, extends this protection to the claims of creditors of a beneficiary of a retirement plan other than the participant. A classic example would be the participant's spouse. So, for example, Mr. Chairman, if you had a retirement plan, an IRA, or another type of retirement plan, and you died and your beneficiary was your spouse, those assets would then be protected from creditors of your spouse. The same general concept that retirement assets are there to help that person through his or her elder years, and they should be protected from creditors. Sections 2 and 3 are just conforming and definitional changes with respect to this provision I just described. Section 4 deals with clarifying a statute that we have that is generally referred to as a virtual representation statute. This statute basically says that, for example, a parent can represent a minor child or unborn children when that parent is reviewing and entering into an agreement for a settlement. Now, it's clear that the statute applies to judicial settlements, that is, settlements that have gone through the court system and then are being resolved. This amendment would clarify that it also, this type of virtual representation can occur with respect to settlements that occur outside of court. A classic example would be a trust accounting, where all of the beneficiaries are asked to approve a trust accounting. Well, a parent could approve it for his child rather than having to go to court and ask the court to appoint a guardian ad litem for that child and have another attorney involved and review all the same things again. If the parent's interests are the same as his child's would be, there's no sense in having that extra technical work. So this would clarify that statute. Sections 6 through 8 of the bill deal with a method for modifying existing trusts that's commonly referred to as decanting or pouring assets from one trust into another, like pouring wine from one bottle into another. These decanting statutes originally began in the 1990s. New York was the first statute. Alaska enacted its own statute in 1998, copying New York's statute. At the present time, there are 13 states that have enacted statutes like this, and there are 3 more pending in other legislatures. New York recently did a very thorough revision to its modification or decanting statute, and this proposed amendment closely tracks the changes that New York made. It's important to have a statute that allows for modifications in order to correct errors in trust documents and to adjust trust documents to change circumstances and laws. This statute, as New York has revised it and as we have followed it, have built in many safeguards for the beneficiaries. Sections 9 on, let's see, deal with really it would be 9 through 25, deal with amendments to Alaska's Uniform Principal and Income Act. In 2003, the legislature enacted this modern act, and one of the basic concepts in this act is to allow for what's called a unit trust or total return trust. And the reason for that was previously, many trusts would have a provision that says, for example, the income goes to my wife, and the principal, after my wife's death, will go to my children. And so all of a sudden there was a built-in conflict in that trust instrument for a trustee trying to administer it. The trustee could invest for income, for example, in bonds that would produce more income, or the trustee could invest in equities, stocks, that would produce more growth. The spouse would want the bonds, the children would want the stock, and so you have this built-in conflict for the trustee who couldn't satisfy anyone, couldn't make anybody really happy. The concept of a unit trust is, instead of doing that, to direct the trustee to pay out a percentage, and our original statute in 2003 said 4%. So the trustee each year will just pay out 4% of the assets of the trust. And the trustee is allowed to invest the trust in the best way to get the best total return. It really doesn't matter if it's in income or in principal, because the trustee every year is just taking the whole total value of the trust and distributing out 4%. So that's what's called the unit trust approach. What this bill has done since 2003, the Internal Revenue Service has issued regulations with respect to unit trusts, and other jurisdictions have updated their act to conform to these regulations and to remedy areas that needed improvement. So these amendments basically give the trustee more leeway to choose a unit trust rate of 3 to 5%, anywhere in that range, rather than just 4%, provides a definition of income for a trust drafted as a unit trust. It provides for ordering of distributions among the different types of income and principal, which the Internal Revenue Service looks at, for example, ordinary income, capital gain, return of principal. It extends a smoothing period. A smoothing period is the period over which you take an average to determine the amount of assets in the trust. So if you're taking 5% of the assets every year and distributing them out, instead of just taking last year's total of assets, you take the average over the last 5 years. And this results in a smoother amount of distribution, a more consistent amount of annual distributions than highs and lows that might result if you were to look at each year and the years vary. The bill also clarifies how the unit trust rules will apply to retirement benefits. So all of these amendments just really bring us up to date with the modern use of the unit trust concept, which is developed under the Uniform Principal and Income Act. Now, sections 26 through 28 are a very interesting improvement on the Uniform Transfer to Minors Act. Every state pretty much has adopted this act, and what this act allows a person to do is to create an account for their minor child and to make annual gifts. Usually the gifts are made under the tax-free gifting amount, which today is $13,000 per year. So a person can create that account, and the account is then supervised by a custodian, which is another term really for trustee, who invests those funds and then uses them for the benefit of the minor. For example, if the minor is going to college or a high school that requires the tuition and other types of fees and costs, if the minor has any other needs. And then depending on the type of contribution to the account, the funds become the minors at either age 18 or 21. If it's a gift, it's under age 21. Under present law, when the person creates this kind of account, they can say, instead of age 21, I want it to be age 25. They can't go any farther than that. And the minor has to have the right to withdraw the assets at age 21, but the minor can agree to extend them to age 25. Well, there have been a number of situations, not only in Alaska, but in our field, we hear about at conferences all over the country, where substantial amounts of funds have been deposited in this type of account, but the miner really isn't ready to take over the management of those funds at age 21 or 25, either because of immaturity or inability to manage funds or substance abuse or other handicaps or problems. Often the miner is willing to have the account extended for a further period of time. And what this bill does is allow then for the extension of such an account if the miner agrees to do that. So, for example, a custodian, as the miner approaches age 21, may see that the miner has these problems and may go to the miner and first have it extended, have the account extended to age 25. At age 25, the custodian again may see the problems really haven't been remedied and say to the miner, look, let's hold this in trust till age 35. I'll continue, of course, under the Act. I'm required to use it for your benefit, but I'll manage it for you. And often the miner will agree to that, so it will be extended to age 35. This Act, these amendments allow for this type of extension, and we really think it will be very helpful to many families who have seen this kind of situation develop. Section 29 is what's called a remains statute, and getting down to very basic situations that all of us are going to have to face is essentially who has the power to dispose of a person's remains after they die. This became an issue before our estate planning section. It was brought before us by the funeral parlor industry, where they point out that Alaska has not actually covered this kind of issue. You can have people fighting over one person wants to take the remains back east to where the person was born and have them buried. Another person wants to have them cremated here in Alaska. You have problems like that develop, and the funeral industry then ends up just being paralyzed and having to hold these remains for months at a time until a court resolves it one way or another. What this bill would provide a adequate authority for allowing a person to provide directions, to provide a form directing who has the authority to dispose of their remains. This will probably become just a part and parcel of all basic estate planning done in Alaska. If a person fails to have any estate planning done, there's a priority list provided as to the persons who will control the disposition of the decedent's remains. Now, Section 30 of the bill deals with a problem that has come up and that the Uniform Law Commission has recognized and made amendments to the Uniform Trust Code, and that's what we're trying to also adopt here. And this deals with what's called an insurable interest. Very often in estate planning, insurance policies are held in an irrevocable trust. And there are a number of reasons for this. One of the primary ones is that then the insurance proceeds will not be taxed under the federal estate tax. Other reasons just have to do with asset protection after the person dies and protecting assets in trust for that deceased person's beneficiaries. In 2005, there was a federal district case called Chowla back in the Eastern District of Virginia. And basically, that court looked at the statute, and every state has what's called an insurable interest statute. This statute is designed to make sure that the people who buy insurance on somebody else's life have some kind of a reason to buy that insurance. I mean, such as a relative or somebody involved in a business transaction that needs insurance because of a loan they're extending. Now, that's called an insurable interest. These laws are designed to prevent people from gambling on other people's lives. Say, saying, you know, that person doesn't look too good today. I wonder if I could buy a policy on their life, and it'd be a worthwhile investment, even though I have no other interest in that person. So that's what's called an insurable interest statute. In our statute, like the statute in many states, really wasn't specific enough. And this district court in Virginia basically said, we're not sure that this covers life insurance trusts or other business entities like partnerships or limited liability companies that are used to hold insurance for the benefit of that person's relatives. So, again, the Uniform Commissioners adopted changes to the Uniform Trust Code to solve this problem, and we're following them with a similar amendment. Now, Section 31 deals with the transfer of IRA interests. In estate planning, often what we do, both for to minimize federal transfer taxes and also for asset protection and management purposes, is we transfer property interests either by gift or by sales or other modes to other family members or to trusts for their benefit. What this would allow is, would allow persons to transfer their IRA interests generally to trusts for similar kinds of tax and asset protection benefits, primarily tax benefits. And this would allow, for example, a person to transfer their IRA interest to a trust that they create. It would generally be called a grantor trust. It's designed so it wouldn't have any negative income tax consequences. It would be a gift when they transfer it in at the value of that account, but then the growth of that account would not be taxed under the federal estate tax. Sections 32 through 36, in effect, modernize Alaska's optional community property system, which was enacted by the legislature in 1998. There have been several amendments over the years to improve that provision. What we recommend here are provisions that deal essentially with title and wrongful transfers of community property. First, these amendments reference to a community property trust, which is often used in order to opt into Alaska's optional community property system. They clarify the statute of limitations and incorporate a new statute of limitations dealing with wrongful transfers of community property. And community property is very unusual. It's 10 states, mostly the western states, have a community property system, which is basically a system that says the husband and wife own equally and share equally in what's called community property. The 9 other states, the default system is community property. In Alaska, we opt into, we have an optional community property system. The default system is a separate property system, but many people, in my estate planning practice, almost all of my clients who are married opt into the community property system. It has some very attractive both ownership but also federal income tax benefits. But what is unusual about community property in all states is that the actual form of title to the property may differ from the fact that it's community property. And so this statute is recognizing that and pointing out that regardless of the form of community property, form of title, so the title might be, let's say, just in the wife's name, but if the husband and wife agree in a separate agreement that it's community property, that agreement controls. If the title, for example, is a tenancy by the entirety, which is a survivorship type of ownership, which means that if one spouse dies, all of the property then is owned by the surviving spouse, then that's going to be presumed to be their intent with respect to the community property as well. If it's community property, and let's say it's a bank account that has for a beneficiary designation on it, where you can designate who gets it after people die, a beneficiary designation done by one spouse effective for that spouse's half interest unless the other spouse consents in writing. For various family designations are presumed to have been made with the consent of the other spouse, but this presumption can be overcome by the testimony of the surviving spouse. And the remedies have been enacted for improper transfers of community property by one spouse and limitation periods within which those remedies must be pursued. So that's a sectional analysis of SB 292, which really is, in the trust and estate area, contains a lot of very important and improvements that will affect a large number of Alaska residents.
Well, Mr. Schaftel, I thank you very much for that explanation and sectional. Questions of Mr. Schaftel by the committee? Seeing none, thank you very, very much. And now we will open this up to public testimony. And online I have Douglas Blattmacher. I think I pronounced that correct. Blattmacher?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it's Douglas Blattmacher, and I'm President and CEO of Alaska Trust Company. And we think that this is a very good piece of legislation. It does modernize Alaska's trust laws, and we strongly support it.
All right. Is there any questions, Mr. Blattmacher? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anybody
thank
else
you.
In the room or online that would like to testify on House Bill 292? Seeing none, that brings it back to the committee for discussion. Any further discussion by the committee? Can I have a motion then to move House Bill 292 out of committee?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 292, version India, with committee attached fiscal note and individual recommendations from committee. Zero fiscal note.
And zero fiscal note. Any objection? Seeing none, House Bill 292 will move from committee. And that does conclude our business for today. Friday's House Judiciary meeting was scheduled for bills previously heard, and at this time there are no bills ready to be taken up again, so we will not meet on Friday.
We're not going to continue with this
bill. We just passed it out of committee. And it is now 2:40 p.m., and we are adjourned.